Bill Nell is a paranormal researcher with almost 40 years of experience. And ever since starting a UFO club in high school, he has personally investigated thousands of UFO, ghosts, and other paranormal sightings, encounters, events. Some of his more interesting cases involve a UFO sighting by President Kennedy, Jackie Gleason's alleged viewing of a crashed UFO and alien, Howard Hughes' alleged viewing of a crashed UFO, and abduction cases where cars were simply lifted off the road by UFOs in rush hour traffic in New York and New Jersey. Now, Bill, that's the way to travel, though, isn't it?
I'm telling you.
Tell me, a UFO club in high school, how in the heck did you start that?
Well, you know, I grew up in a military family. My father was a retired military officer, you know, and I used to hear a lot of stories about pilots talking about UFOs, some of his friends that were serving with him during World War II and stuff. And I guess by the time high school came around, I just accumulated this huge amount of books about UFOs and ghosts and things. So I thought it would be kind of cool to offer these books as available, you know, to people to loan out. So I happen to have a very progressive science teacher in high school. And although he was, you know, somewhat skeptical, mm-hmm. he was open to the experience. And I said to him, you know, people ask me all the time about UFOs, and I'm handing him out books. Suppose I bring some of my books in, because at that time, my goodness, I probably had, I don't know, a library of close to 500 books, you know, a lot of paperbacks, some hardbacks. I said, suppose I bring these books in and let people, you know, loan them out, if you will. And he kind of liked the idea, and he gave me this closet in the back of his classroom to do this. And my little paranormal lending library became so popular that he suggested you know, when the time comes around every year when you're in high school for the clubs to form, people have math clubs and chess sure. clubs and all that. He said, you know, you should really, you know, form a UFO club. I said, come on, there's probably not a handful of people in the school that actually would show up. He said, well, give it a try. So I said, okay. So I went and filled out all the forms and everything and announced the formation of the UFO club. And I figured, okay, at worst, a few people as nutty as me, you know, will show up and we'll talk about UFOs, have a good time. Of course, it was an after-school thing,
yeah.
and you did get extra credit for it, which was good. So I figured, all right, so we get things started, and the time comes for the UFO club's first meeting. Everyone comes to sign up, and I'm sitting there by myself. I'm thinking no one's going to show up, and then it was like a flood of humanity. I mean, I was blown away. Teachers, students, even the school principal showed up for the first meeting. And it just blew me away because one of the things that happened there was I learned a very valuable lesson. I learned that people had UFO sightings, you know, that they had and had no place to report them. I mean, I went to high school in 1971. So, you know, Project Blue Book was over by then. So people were very frustrated when they had a UFO sighting to report. They had no place to report it.
Exactly.
And one of the highlights of the meeting for me was having my school principal, by the way, this occurred in both Boca Ciega High School in Gulfport, Florida, and my high school principal was this tough ex-Marine Corps drill sergeant, and he came out, and he had this amazing little UFO story to tell. While he had been serving in Vietnam, he had seen this bizarre kind of greenish-colored object that he had no explanation for, and it kind of buzzed his camp. Now, when he told his commanding officer about it and the officer of the day, they basically blew it off. They said, well, you know, don't worry about it. And he's like, what do you mean don't worry about it? I have to write this stuff up. He thought that their response was odd at best, and he never forgot about it. He told our entire group about it, and then some of the other teachers told their stories, and then some of the people told their stories. So I was pretty excited because we must have had 100 people sign up for our little UFO club, you know.
That's great. And as you grew, you kept this love of the mysteries of the unknown, Bill. I can tell just in your passion in your voice.
Well, you know what happened to me, too, was I mean, I really hadn't planned any of this. It's almost as if the paranormal and people involved with the paranormal were drawn to me. For example, one of the things that started happening after we formed our little UFO club was people started contacting us about their sightings. In fact, my science teacher basically oversaw the whole thing, and, of course, he loved it because for him it was interesting. And one of the first things that we were contacted about was a UFO sighting that occurred by a bunch of children at a local elementary school. So I'm thinking, well, this is interesting. And they were saying that they saw a UFO. So I'm like, okay. Myself and five of the other club members, as well as the science teacher, contacted individually this group of kids. And the story got really interesting because it turned out it went from being this little sighting to nine kids that had went to a playground at 4 o'clock in the afternoon at an elementary school that was less than a mile from our high school, saw a disc land in the back of the school by the playground. And when we went there, we found, guess what, a crop circle. So now we've got all these kids.
Incredible.
We've got a UFO sighting, we've got a landing, but it gets better. Because as we began to talk to the kids and the parents, we discovered that actually the kids never came home that night until about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and the parents were worried sick. And to the kids, a few minutes had only gone by. So now we had, you know, a UFO sighting, a UFO landing, a crop circle, and like nine kids with missing time. And I didn't even know what to do. I was just, you know, I think I was 16. And coincidentally, things started to roll into place because my librarian, the librarian at our school library, got wind of all of this. And I thought that, you know, being a librarian and all, she probably would think this was crazy. But she worked with us, too, because she had all the copy machines and everything. And anytime we needed anything copied, we'd have to go see her.
Yeah.
And her name was Mrs. Mitchell. And I had no way of knowing this, but Mrs. Mitchell was the wife of George Mitchell, who happened to be a very big local television personality there in Florida.
Ah, okay.
He actually had a show that preceded the Today Show in the morning back in those days. It was like an hour-long local television show, you know? And she said, you know, my husband would probably love to have you on this show. And so, you know, me and the science teacher and several other members went on the show, talked about all the stuff we were doing, and some of the kids came on the show and talked about it. And I had no way of knowing this, but that feed actually went throughout the state of Florida. Our little UFO club went crazy. You know, the newspapers were covering it. We were getting, invited to do radio interviews. And I don't know. I guess before I knew it, I was kind of, you know, almost trapped into this whole thing. I mean, you've had certain, you know, paranormal things in your life, so you know what it's like, you know. Once it grabs you, you know, it's hard to get loose.
Bill, how did you expand into ghost investigating in areas like that?
Well, again, it really started with the UFO club because, again, when someone has a paranormal encounter, there's not a lot of options. And we started getting, you know, I started having friends and stuff once they became aware that I was interested in UFOs. I guess they just assumed I was interested in all this stuff. And actually, I was. I mean, from the very beginning, I was a huge fan of Hans Holzer. Now, I had seen some of his work on television. I'd watched his specials. He was the first ghost hunter, and he wrote a book, in fact, called Ghost Hunter.
Yes.
And if anyone gets a chance, they should read Alexandra Holzer's book about her life with him. She's his youngest daughter. He's an amazing guy. He's still around. He's still with us. But, you know, I became entranced with the work of these people, these pioneers, if you will. And people just started reporting their sightings. I'll tell you a really – I have time to tell a little ghost story?
Oh, you've got 3 hours, Bill.
Well, this is a cool one because it's out of the ordinary. And I've never known exactly what to make of it. But one of my friends in high school came to me, and his father was a carpenter. And he would go and he would buy these kind of like beat-up houses, you know, fix them up and then sell them for a profit.
Yeah, today, rehab
today
and make
that
a
flipping, you know, houses.
Exactly.
But he had this one house where his daughter was staying. His daughter was going to college, and she was living in the house temporarily, just watching the place. You know, they had fixed up beautiful house, beautiful new bathroom, new kitchen, everything. And she kept having problems in the house with weird lights. And the bathroom in particular was the focal point of the house because you get this feeling of dread. Now, I at that time knew two ladies that I'd met at a local library, and they were involved in a spiritualist church. So they were spiritualists, so I kind of got them involved because I didn't know a lot about ghosts. You know, I was just a kid at the time. So they came out, and I went out, and couple of the people from the UFO club, including the science teacher, came out to have a look at what was going on in the house. And there were some strange things. I mean, we sitting around in the house, I mean, I experienced this myself. It was like someone was touching you that wasn't there. But more importantly, I noticed it myself, this horrible feeling of dread toward the bathroom. And the woman involved, the daughter, told me that there were these strange lights that kept going on and off it got to the point where she wouldn't stay in the house. And I have to admit, I mean, I don't consider myself sensitive per se, but walking in that house gave me the willies, you know.
You could feel it, couldn't you?
Well, it actually got to the point where the spiritual slaves refused to go back with me, you know. I thought, well, that's not good, you know.
No, when the spiritual person doesn't want in, it's time to go.
Yeah, exactly. So I thought, okay, what's going on? So I worked on this for weeks and weeks and weeks, and I had the idea, let's go around the neighborhood and ask some of the people, because, again, the house had been flipped. So was there anything going on at that house, you know, that maybe a murder or something crazy? You never know. It doesn't hurt to ask. The house itself was probably only about 25 years old, so it wasn't a very old house at that time. So I was about to give up, and then finally on a Saturday, my friend calls me, and he says, you're not going to believe what happened. I'm like, what? He said, well, you need to meet me at the house. So we go over to the troubled house, and there's just police everywhere. Now, here's the bizarre thing. The owner of the home that was in back of the house that would have been facing the bathroom of the troubled house had killed his entire family and himself.
Oh, my God.
Now, after that happened, all the trouble in this other house stopped. So you could go and say this was probably not per se a ghost haunting. It could have been a case of precognition, which is what I'm thinking it was, and somehow spilled over into this house. It was just the most bizarre thing that I've ever experienced. But after that happened, everything got very, very quiet in that house. Then I worked on another case where a man kept seeing this woman walk through his house. Now, when I say a woman walked through his house, she looked as real as you or I. I mean, a full-bodied apparition that just was, you know, apart from being able to touch her, which he was not, because he never actually tried, you know, she just seemed very real. But it's like the stories you hear. She'd turn a corner, you know, and then not be there. Now, this happened in the Chicago area. This was years later, but I'm just telling a story because it's an interesting ghost-related story. And I'm just trying to point out that not everything is always what it seems. But anyway, to make a long story short, she basically would vanish, and then I started investigating this because he came out to one of my seminars that I was giving in the area. And it was funny. I didn't see him for about, 3 years. And then when I went back there 3 years later, he brought this, came back out to my seminar again, and he brought this woman with him. He said, Bill, this is the woman I saw in my house. But here's the bizarre part. I only met her in the last year, and we married.
Oh, my.
So he had some sort of precognitive viewing of a person that he was going to marry that was going to live in his house. But at the time it occurred, of course, he hadn't met her yet, and he had no idea who she was or what she looked like. So, you know, stuff like that just, you know, you can't get enough of.
Yeah, you can't. And sometime toward the end of the show, Bill, I want to devote some time and chat with you about your ghost hunting.
Sure.
Because that's an area that everybody really is fascinated with. Did you have lunch? Because I was reading some of the work you've done. Did you have lunch with Walter Cronkite and talk with him about this UFO sighting he had?
Yes, that was the direct result of the UFO Club, because as I told you previously, basically I went on the George Michel show once, actually many times, but the first time I went on there, the feed went out through Florida, and somehow or another, I guess it was in the early 70s, Cronkite was putting together this special that CBS News wanted to do on UFOs, because they had done a couple before, and they had had really good response to the specials. And so he was put in charge of it, he was going to host it, and really, you know, he was such a big figure in terms of the you know, his work at CBS that,
oh my gosh,
you know, anything he wanted to do, you know, he did. And of course, whenever he was in charge of a project, he had carte blanche. So basically, he wanted to line up some people that he could talk to about UFOs, and he wanted to do something different. He didn't want the usual suspects. So somehow or another, he became aware of what I was doing, and I was so young, you know. I think he just wanted a young person's perception of what was going on, you know, with UFOs. So I got a letter from CBS, showed it to my parents. My parents were like, wow, this is very interesting, because they were big fans of Cronkite. So we called and we made arrangements, and I flew. I'm from New York, so I had relatives there. It wasn't a problem for me to go to New York and of course, meet with Cronkite. And I wasn't the only one. There were lots of people. But I got to have lunch with him by myself, which I thought was pretty cool.
Oh, that is cool. Yeah.
It was. But I was, as I said, I wasn't the only one. This is the way he interviewed people. And we're sitting there talking, and his primary interest in me was, because I'd grown up in an Air Force family and had a father that had been on General MacArthur's staff during World War II and participated in various things, including a Foo Fighter report and stuff. So we talked about all the pilot sightings I heard about. And then, you know, he was really interested in what I had to say. And then out of the blue, I mean, you know, of course, I'm not going to ask him any questions. He's Walter Cronkite. But out of the blue, he starts talking about this UFO sighting he had. And the way he did it, it's amazing. You talk about someone who is so smooth, calm, and collected, you know?
Yeah.
Just kind of, before I knew it, he was telling me this UFO sighting. He said that he was part of a pool of reporters that had been invited out to watch some sort of a new missile test at a small Pacific atoll. And this was probably sometime in the mid-50s. He never told me the exact location. But, you know, I could tell from the way he was relating the story that it was true when he was relating it strictly from memory. And he said that before the test, everybody was standing outside this little blockhouse and looking at the missile and looking at it on the launching pad, and there were guards walking around with dogs. And before anybody knew it, just as the test was about to begin, this classic huge flying saucer, flying disc, dull metal, you know, what everyone thinks of when they think of a flying saucer, appeared over the missile site. Now, what it apparently did was it shot a blue beam at the missile just as the missile was taking off. So it basically froze the missile in mid-launch. It probably wasn't more than 50 feet above the ground, the missile.
And Cronkite witnessed this?
He was witnessing, but it gets better. It gets better because he told me, he said, what really freaked him out was there was a guard dog barking at this thing and a guard standing there, and a blue beam hit the guard and the dog was literally frozen in mid-jump. So he's staring at all this. Now, bear in mind, the whole episode probably didn't last more than 20 seconds, but you can imagine watching it. It's like frozen in time in your head, you know.
Yeah.
And he remembered it all, and he said that all of a sudden, the blue beam on the guard, the dog, and the missile was gone, but the missile exploded. And everybody started running for the hills, you know. Now, the guard was okay, and the dog was okay. No one was seriously injured, but everybody ran down into the blockhouse. You know, what else are you going to do?
Right.
So about 30 minutes go by, and everybody's kind of huddling in there. The military police, I guess the air police, it would have been, the air police were everywhere. And finally, after about 30 minutes, this Fulberg Air Force colonel comes down there and comes up with this amazing story. You know, he gets everybody out of the bunker. He says, listen, this was basically a test. We were testing how people in the media would react if they saw what they believed to be, you know, an alien spacecraft to come and have some sort of an encounter with the military. So they were trying to sell Walter Cronkite, you know, on the idea that this had just been a test. Now, he didn't buy it, and he told me that every other reporter there with him, and there probably was about 20 other people, didn't buy it either. But they were all told, you know, you can't talk about it. It was a test. We wanted to see how you'd react. But it was amazing because he said he could not imagine that we would have had the technology to pull this off. And he said, in fact, we did not. He did not buy the story. But, you know, I'm seeing, you know, I wanted to ask him some questions. It was just you know, in me to do that, but I wasn't about to do that, you know. So I didn't talk about the story for a long time, you know. And then over the years, I met a few people that had heard the story as well from him, that had worked with him. And then I felt kind of comfortable, and I think I started talking about it maybe 4 or 5 years after he told it to me, because I felt like he had confided in, you know, confided in me with the story. I didn't know, he never said not to talk about it, but I just got the impression this was a personal conversation between him and me. Of course, I wanted to tell everybody, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, I mean, it's Walter Cronkite, and I was very impressed. And then it did make me feel better that other people had heard the story as well. So, you know, if you find that story on the Internet, this is where it actually came from.
It's an incredible story, Bill. Stay with it. Hey, Bill, how do people get a hold of you, or if they need to email you some stories?
Sure. All you have to do is go to my website at ufoguy.com. That's ufoguy.com or 911ufo.com. Either one's fine.
All right. Stay with us. More stories from Bill Nell in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, the President Kennedy UFO case that he spotted in Hyannisport, that fascinates me too. Tell me about your involvement or your investigation on this one.
Well, that was pretty interesting, and actually I came upon it almost completely by accident. I know from time to time on your show you've had guests that have talked about Dr. Michael Wolff, and of course he was a pretty interesting guy, and I had met him by phone through another friend of mine. and started talking to him about some of the experiences that he had. He was a former government scientist, and he had a lot of information about UFOs. But one of the things that, on a personal level, that was interesting about him was that his wife, Sarah, who died years ago, was a Kennedy. And interestingly enough, he had spent some time at the Kennedy compound in Hyannisport in Massachusetts. So we started talking, and I said, you know, do you know anything about JFK? He said, well, I don't really like talking about it, but I'll tell you honestly, him and I guess Michael and Sarah were out at the compound the summer right before JFK was assassinated. And I guess that he and a few other people went out in one of the motor launches. Apparently they have several out there. And what Michael, unfortunately, wasn't able to go out and launch because he was very sick with the flu in bed at that time. But his wife went out and a bunch of other people. And I guess it was only a few minutes that they were out in the launch when they saw a classic, you know, again, flying saucer disc-shaped object, which it just kind of hovered, I would say, about several hundred feet based on what he told me, from the boat. Now, interestingly enough, the object, it's funny because after I started telling the story in some of my seminars over the years, I met a couple of other people who had been there when this occurred or had been in the area when this occurred, and they remembered it. And everybody said it was about 60 feet in diameter, you know, classic disc. The middle was slightly raised up, and it was just a classic flying saucer. And, I mean, everybody that was there said the Secret Service went crazy. You know, they probably had two other small boats that were or launches that were around the presidents, and they didn't know what to do. You know, it was almost like a scene from one of those old 60s movies where all the boats are running into each other. You know, nobody knew what to do with each other. But apparently the thing just went straight up at a tremendous speed and vanished after a very, very short amount of time. Everybody estimated under about a minute. Now, at this point, everybody was brought back to the dock. And before anybody could do anything, and, of course, this is typical of President Kennedy, he really took the bull by the horns and said, look, whatever happened, we're not going to talk about it. We don't know exactly what happened, but we think it's best if nobody talks about it. And really, nobody did for a while. Sarah went in and told Michael about it, and he only talked about it in the last 10 years before his death. And then, like I said, in the process of going around the country and speaking, I used to do around 100 seminars a year. I occasionally, especially went up to the Northeast, I'd run into people who had been there at the time this occurred and told me that, wow, you know, we actually saw that happen. And, you know, I knew enough about the story and had always withheld a little bit, you know, so that if they told me the story and they were really there, they would know certain things happened. And they did. So I believe that the story is credible. Of course, there's other people. I know you've even had guests on that have talked about him knowing things about UFOs. I think that might have been where it started. I think that at some point he had this experience and there were other people there, and it probably piqued his interest.
One of the myths, Bill, that Marilyn Monroe was killed because she was going to go public over the things that John Kennedy told her about UFOs. Now, I don't know how far-fetched that might be, but that was always something that people talked about, the possibility. Did you ever come across that?
I never came across that. But you know what? It's wrong for people to underestimate what the government will do to keep this secret. I mean, we hear a lot about disclosure, and we hope for it. I don't think there's a single UFO researcher out there that doesn't hope for some sort of exposure. But I can tell you, look, I grew up in an Air Force family. My father was an officer. He served on General MacArthur's staff during World War II. Interestingly enough, his expertise was more in material, and it was only because he was very good at getting stuff moved around that was needed that he ended up working on MacArthur's staff. He was actually in the Army Air Corps at the time. And when he did, interestingly enough, and this is one of the reasons I got involved or interested in UFOs, he used to tell me how that the pilots during World War II would see these strange objects, which ultimately ended up being called, you know, Foo Fighters.
Right.
And apparently, MacArthur became so concerned about them that he ordered a report done. What he basically did was, during the normal debriefing sessions that occurred with pilots, at least in the South Pacific, and I'm assuming in Europe as well, but the ones in the South Pacific, anytime someone mentioned seeing anything unusual, they were brought back for more questions. And whatever was the result of that questioning was put into this report. Now, at the end of World War II, one of the interesting things that my father said was that when they examined the captured Japanese war records, the first thing they found out was that the Japanese pilots were seeing these things as well, not just the American pilots. And, in fact, the German pilots had seen them also. This really piqued MacArthur's interest. You know, he was like, whoa, wanted to know what was going on with it. And I guess that he included all this material in the report. Now, today, the government will acknowledge that the report exists, but it's classified. You can't get it. So, you know, it's interesting that it's over 10,000 pages long. I mean, think about that for 5 seconds, you know, and you still can't get a copy of the report. And I can tell you, you know, I thought it was interesting as a kid to have these pilots that my dad knew come over to the house for barbecues and stuff that had served, you know, during World War II, Korea, and so on. And it was always funny because I was being told in school, and I grew up mainly in the 60s, so I heard, you know, the reports from the teachers that the government would say, well, you know, most of the people that see these things, they're just untrained observers. They don't know anything. And I found that fascinating because, you know, here I was hearing the story from the horse's mouth, you know, from pilots. And
exactly. It
was amazing to me how these pilots would be treated like national heroes, you know, which they are. You know, amazing people. You know, the government spent millions of dollars to turn them into pilots and thought nothing but the best of them. And I would imagine almost anything they wrote down in terms of reports or intel, the government would pay attention to, except when they saw a UFO. You know, then they were delusional or depressed or something was going on in their life. You know, it was amazing how quick the government turned on them. And I think that should be a warning, in a sense, you know, to anyone who thinks the government will not do whatever they have to do to keep this a secret. I'll tell you a quick story that really got my goat. And one of the things that really got me involved, in fact, it caused me to read my first UFO book, which was Flying Saucers, Serious Business by Frank Edwards.
Frank Edwards, a great journalist in his time.
Oh, man, I became such a fan of his. But anyway, we were out at a base barbecue at Edwards Air Force Base, and it had to be in the early 60s, and I was, you know, very young at the time, but I do recall this. The keynote speaker of, you know, at that particular time was the gentleman who actually broke the sound barrier. I'm trying to remember his name just offhand. It's in the middle of the night, so I'm forgetting.
Chuck Yeager?
Chuck Yeager. I am sorry. Having one of those senior moments, if you will.
Hey, I'm glad I had it, or we both would have had a senior moment, right?
There you go. I apologize for that. But anyway, Chuck Yeager had was talking about something totally different, you know? And somebody yelled up to him, hey, Chuck, you know, have you seen any of these flying saucers? Because you got to remember, this is the early 1960s when these things are constantly in the news, you know? And Yeager said, well, I'll tell you this story. And he basically, you know, kind of gave us a capsulated version. He was testing one of the early versions of the X-planes. And I guess that, you know, just the standard procedure was he'd test the plane. When he came down after he landed, they'd watch the film from that day's flight. You'd have the flight engineer in there. You'd have a couple of Air Force officers, you know, different people. The General Electric built the engines for those planes, so you'd have the flight engineers in there as well and the General Electric people. But on this particular day, when he's flying, all of a sudden, off the starboard side of his aircraft, he sees this huge, huge, you know, flying saucer-type object. Typical dull metal. You know, so far we only seem to be talking about saucers. I don't want to give people that the impression that that's all that's out there, but this is what he saw. He said the thing came out in front of him. Now, at this point, you have to understand these early jets did not have a huge amount of control to them. So he's thinking to himself, but this is what he said to everybody. He said, you know, if this thing stops, I'm a bug on its window, you know, and he was really concerned about it. Then the thing just vanished. So, you know, he reports all this. He lands. He goes into the room where they have the debriefing. Now, there's no projector, no screen. So he's thinking, okay, we're not going to see that film anymore, you know. And instead of the flight engineers and the GE guys and everybody else, it's just him and a couple of guys in suits. Talk about men in black.
Right.
They claim to be Air Force security. Now, you know, you say Air Force security, that could mean anything. So they start giving him, and here we go again. They start telling him, well, you know what, Chuck? What happened today, we want you to kind of forget about it because, you know, what you saw was a new prototype. Now, when I thought about it later, you know, I was just a kid at the time, but I thought he must have had a great time laughing to himself.
Yeah, because every aircraft that we had.
I know. They're telling, like, America's greatest test pilot, you know, and a guy that knows all the other ones, you know, at that day, flying on the, you know, the high desert in California, that he basically said, well, if that's true, I should be flying it. You know, why am I wasting time with this you know, hunk of junk, basically.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I was freaked out by that. I mean, and I never forgot it. And my father and I, my father passed away a few years ago, but we talked about it over and over and over again because it was so typical. I mean, you know, and I would assume, you know, I may be wrong, but I would assume that Yeager had an awful lot of information and probably some very high clearances, and yet even he had to be told this fairy story, you know, that they couldn't trust him with the truth. So, you know, yeah, you know, you never know what happens. You know, you mentioning Marilyn Monroe and all, but I can tell you that to the government, this is very serious business, and they really do go out of their way to keep these secrets.
You have some information about the late Howard Hughes viewing a crashed UFO. This is an incredible story.
Yeah, this was pretty interesting, and actually, it only came my way recently. You know, one of the things I started doing, I started writing about UFOs as early as high school, and then I continued writing about them ever since. So, you know, people either they'll come out to my seminars, or they'll go to my website, or they'll, you know, read my articles somewhere. And one of the things that was interesting about the Hughes incident was that I had a person named Linda contact me who had I guess she'd read one of my articles or something, and she was really fascinated with the whole UFO thing because of a story that she heard from her dad. Now, her dad worked with Howard Hughes during the summer of 1947. That was a very important time for him because it was during that time that he was trying to prepare the famous Spruce Goose, which ultimately became the model for the C-130, you know, the huge transport plane. And for anyone that doesn't know about it, it was basically this, you know, plywood monster, you know.
Yeah, it was a wooden plane.
Oh, man. And people swore the thing would never get off the ground, you know. And there were some other issues, too. He had been involved in the XF-11 photo reconnaissance aircraft project during the war and after World War II. And I guess he had made an enemy in Congress who was, well, this congressman was kind of in cahoots with somebody else that was one of his business enemies, if you will, to make a long story short. So he was going through these congressional hearings, you know. He had the Spruce Goose thing going. And her father apparently was working with him on the Spruce Goose project. Now, he went to Washington to testify. And when he came back, he took Linda's dad aside. And he basically said, you know, the government showed me something. It's like, well, what? Well, you know, he was a man of few words, and he had a lot of idiosyncrasies, but he did not say this was an alien spacecraft per se, okay? But, you know, you have to remember something. The government went to Howard Hughes when they wanted something unusual done. We have to remember that he was the man who arranged for put out that, you know, kind of funny story about mining the seafloor when he was actually raising a Russian sub in the 70s. I don't know if anybody remembers that story. But, you know, that's what they did. When they want something unusual done, they go to him. So basically, what I'm thinking they did was, of course, this is what Linda told me. She said that he was taken to this base. He didn't say where, but he was taken to this base, and I guess that he was shown, he called it, to quote it, the damnedest stuff I've ever seen. There was a bunch of material, and I guess part of a crashed flying disc or a crashed UFO that he was shown. And the idea was, I'm guessing, or at least how would I say it? What she was trying to say was that he was told that the government wanted him to find out what it was made of and why and how it flew. Because according to what they told him, they said that the material was extremely resistant to heat, cold, and even pressure. And that their best guess, now bear in mind, this is 1947, sometime likely in August. So this could have been
the Roswell crash? Yeah, I was going to say.
It could have been from any number of things that happened before, during, or after that time. But, you know, one of the things that was interesting was they told him that the feeling at that point by their experts was that an implosion caused the crash of this object. Now, apparently after he saw the object, he told Linda's father that he saw dead bodies of the crew members. That's what he called them, the crew members from the aircraft. And actually, according to him, they were mostly intact. Now, to quote, he said they looked like dwarves or, quote, deformed midgets. He said they were wearing these seamless flight suits. Now, as far as, again, whether these were aliens, whether it was a UFO, he never used those terms. But, you know, you don't have to read a lot into the story to figure out what happened. So the reason that he told Linda's father about it was because he wanted Linda's father on board. Linda's father had been working as an engineer, and he wanted him on board for this project if he decided to take the project.
Right.
Now, I'm thinking what happened next. A couple of weeks went by, and then he told Linda's father to forget about the whole thing. Apparently what had happened was, you know, one thing about Howard Hughes is he had to thoroughly control whatever he took on. And I'm thinking that what probably happened was that he would not have that control. He would have a certain amount of control, but this was something too big for him to just like, oh, bring it on over to here and we'll work on. No, that wasn't going to happen, you know. So they must have went with someone else. But to me, it was an incredible story. You know, it's funny too. Over the years, I'd heard inklings about this, but I'd never met anyone who had direct information. Now, what I did, now Linda's a retired school teacher, and she sent me a lot of information. I have it on my website, too, at ufoguy.com. But, you know, she sent me a lot of stuff that proved to me she was who she was.
Right.
And she sent me some pictures of her dad, you know, at Howard Hughes. But, you know, it was an amazing thing that had happened just at that time, because you can't help but think, wow, I just wonder if this was Roswell. You know, could he
it
have
sounds like it.
The Roswell object and the aliens from it.
Well, you know, I don't believe in coincidences, Bill, and it's too close to that July 7th crash, 1947,
exactly.
Way too close. And the similarities, I've seen, the craft pieces of it, and then the occupants. It sounds like he might have seen it.
And he would have never even talked about it to her. Here's the funny thing. They got in an argument over something that was written in the National Enquirer. You know, and he hated that thing. He hated the National Enquirer, and he used to scold Linda for buying it, you know. But she, you know, her and her mom love reading. It's a supermarket tabloid. It's fun to read. So, they got this argument over it, and they said something in there about crashed UFOs that he felt was probably completely wrong, and that's when it came up. You know, he'd never told this story before, never. And this was the first time he really felt comfortable telling it. And he was one of these guys who just wasn't a big storyteller. You know, he didn't have to impress people. I mean, the guy worked with Howard Hughes, for goodness sake. He probably didn't need to make up stories, you know.
That is truly amazing. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about some more of these cases, some incredible cases. And also, what was your involvement during the Phoenix Lights episode?
Well, I was actually in Phoenix at the time. I was doing a seminar there. I lived in Phoenix for several years, but I wasn't living there at that time. But you know what was funny was I was coming into town to do a seminar, and I was driving down I-17 from Flagstaff into
right.
Phoenix. And just when this stuff started, you know what really freaked me out about the whole thing? I saw, and my wife was with me, my kids were with me, we literally saw military convoys, you know, just flying towards the city. I mean, as fast as they could go. All of a sudden, I'll put it to you this way, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, all these police cars came and started moving traffic over to the right and left. They were clearing lanes. So I'm thinking, you know, is the president visiting the town or something? And I thought,
they'd
probably close the road. And there's just military caravans of what looked like National Guard just flying towards the town. Like, what is going on? So I put on the radio, and then people were talking about the sighting at the same time. And I always wondered, I thought, you know, this could not be a coincidence. There must have been some direct military interest or involvement at that time. Because, hey, I and a lot of other people that were on the freeway that day experienced that.
That is something. Bill, stay with us. Bill Nell, our guest, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're at the halfway point with our special guest tonight, Bill Nell. We're going to talk more about some of these incredible UFO cases and then also his ghost hunting. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. Bill, did you ever do any research into the Jackie Gleason UFO case?
Yes, I did. I had a very interesting experience with that. You know, one of the benefits of traveling around and doing as much speaking as I've done is that you get to meet a lot of people and you get to hear a lot of really interesting stories. And, of course, if I didn't, you know, go out there and do the seminars and, you know, get out there and speak, I wouldn't get them. So
that's right.
I was down in Miami area, Miami, Florida, and I was doing a seminar. And before I did the seminar, I did a couple of radio interviews, and I was on a big local AM station, and we were talking about UFOs and UFO crashes and stuff. So I thought it went really well. I went back to my hotel room, and I don't know, somebody left a message for me, and somebody said, you know, Jackie Gleason called. I'm like, sure, you know. I did not really necessarily buy into it, but it wasn't actually him. It was somebody who was representing him. So I went ahead, and I responded to the phone message. and spoke to a gentleman who said that Jackie Gleason wanted to meet me at this bar that he, I don't know if he owned or owned a part interest in or just was a place that he hung out, but it was closed. And he said he wanted to meet me there around lunchtime just to talk with me. Cause, and I'd known about Gleason's reputation because, you know, like a lot of other people, I used to listen to Long John Neville, you know, growing up in New York City on WOR, and hear those amazing conversations, you know. Gleason, who couldn't sleep but would call into the show and make all these amazing pronouncements about UFOs and stuff. And he was a, you know, very intelligent man, you know, to speak with. So, all right, I go ahead and go to Fort Lauderdale, and there was this place called the Jolly Roger Hotel. And met Gleason in this little bar there, and nobody else was in there but him and a few of his people. And I was, of course, thrilled to meet him, and we started talking about UFOs, and he started telling me his story. Now, most people, I think, have heard the story via the fact that he went to an Air Force base, maybe Homestead.
Homestead, yeah.
But that wasn't what I heard.
That's what we hear. Okay.
That's not what he told me. He basically said that, you know, of course, he was a very close friend of Richard Nixon. And apparently, I guess he had done a lot to help get Nixon elected. And at some point, he was invited to the White House, you know, for a party or a dinner in his honor, whatever it may have been. And he had asked Gleason about UFOs, and asked Nixon about UFOs. And
right.
I'm assuming that Nixon had been waiting for this question, you know, because he knew Jackie. The two were golfing partners and such, and he knew of Gleason's interest in the subject. So he basically, Gleason told me that Nixon told him that if he could get over to MacDill Air Force Base, which is located in Tampa, Florida, on the West Coast, he said that he would show him something he'd basically never forget. So, you know, Gleason is slowly relating the story to me, how that he made arrangements to go over to MacDill Air Force Base. And I knew the base very well, by the way, because I'd lived in St. Petersburg for years. And I'd probably passed that base, you know, a zillion times on the freeways in that area, on the highways. And actually, he went to a building which, at the time he told me the story, still existed. I knew the building very well because you could actually see the building from the interstate. It was a big, dark, kind of warehouse-looking building.
Mm-hmm.
So, interestingly enough, I knew exactly what he was talking about. He said he went there, and he said that he entered a room where he was shown this unusual thing. It kind of looked like a broken disc. And amazingly, he sat there at the table and made me a drawing of this thing. I show the drawing in my seminar all the time, and, you know, signed it and everything. And it looked, the drawing kind of showed a broken disc with pieces laying around it. But here's the thing. Part of the disc that wasn't broken was still, like, hovering above the floor. And I guess one of the people that was with him, it must have been his military escort, I don't know who it was, you know, he didn't give me a huge amount of details, but he just really wanted to tell me this story. I could tell he was very, because I told him a lot of stories too, wanted to hear, you know, what I had to say, but I guess he just felt compelled to tell me this story. And he said that he went over and touched the thing, and it moved just ever so slightly. And he felt some of the material, and he described it pretty much the same way that Jesse Marcel did when he saw the material from Roswell. So to make a long story short, I was interested in the fact that the thing was hovering above the floor because one of the stories that came out of Roswell that a lot of people have forgotten or they rarely mention, I think Kevin Randler brought it up a couple of times, was that members of the Roswell Fire Department had said, at least one or more, had said that they at some point had seen parts and pieces of a flying disc that was hovering just above the ground. It was damaged, but it was obviously hovering before the military came and took it away. In fact, that was actually mentioned in the special that HBO did based on some of the work of different people that have written, Stanton Friedman and others who'd written about Roswell. And, you know, what amazed me was that, you know, the story matched what I was hearing. And bear in mind, this was probably only a few years after the original Roswell book came out, which really wasn't, you know, there wasn't a huge amount of information in there. And, you know, the way he was describing what he saw, I could tell he had been there firsthand. Now, when he went into the next room, he said that he was shown, if you will, the aliens or crew members. I forget exactly how he referred to them. I believe that he used the term the crew of the spacecraft. He believed it was a spacecraft, by the way. That's the term he used. I don't know that that's the term his military escort used, but he described, you know, the classic small gray type aliens And he said he saw several of them and that they were in a very good state of preservation. Now, here's the thing. He wasn't sure if they were the crew members of that particular crash or they were from several crashes. He just didn't know. But he told me that, that some of the drawings he made me, he told me that based on what he saw, he felt like this had been a quickly prepared display for his benefit. Now, why would Nixon go through so much trouble, you know, for him? Well, Gleason raised a lot of money for Nixon's presidential campaign. You know, I mean, and he basically helped them.
And they were friends.
They were friends and, you know, obviously very influential in Nixon's life, Gleason was. So I can imagine him going, and of course, you know, to some extent, Nixon was a guy, if you've ever read the books about him, who had a lot of delusions of grandeur. You know, he liked to be able to believe, in a sense, that he could snap his fingers and make almost anything happen.
Yeah.
So I'm certain he had the, if you will, the knowledge and probably the power to make something like this happen for Gleason. I have no doubt about it. So Gleason told me he was there for about an hour, and I guess he was married to Beverly McKittrick at the time, went home and told her about it. She later mentioned it. I know she was going to write a book about it, but somehow or another, I guess a kibosh was put on the book. You know, it just never came out. How you know, whether the government was involved in that, I don't know. But the book never came out, but she had mentioned it in a couple of interviews she gave later, but I think that she had the location wrong. He'd been gone for, several days, and I think that she probably assumed he went down to Homestead because it was right near where he lived.
Yeah.
But that's not what he told me. He told me it was MacDill, and like I said, if you, I'm not sure the building's there today, but it was there at that time, and of course, when I met with Gleason, we're talking about the late 1980s, actually the mid-1980s, excuse me. So basically, you know, I tended to believe him. I don't think there was anything in it for him not to just the fact that he wanted to tell me the story in the first place. You know, he went through all this trouble to tell it to me. I have no reason to doubt that he was telling me the correct thing. And, you know, what was amazing was later on I actually got to visit his upstate New York home, which, by the way, he called the mothership. I don't know if everybody knew that.
Yeah, he kept a lot of books and things like that on the paranormal.
Oh, man, you know, just looking at some of the stuff he had, you know, I was drooling. My wife and I went there, and we were completely freaked out by his collection, which I understand later went to the Dale Hynek Center for UFO Studies. But, you know, he was someone well-read, very smart, but he was also very tough. You know, you wouldn't want to mess with him. He was basically brought up as an orphan in Brooklyn, you know, and he wasn't, when it came to stuff like the paranormal, he was very serious. He took it as a very serious area of study, so I don't imagine he would have been making up too many stories. You know what's funny? Throughout my life, because, you know, people say, well, how do you have all these amazing stories? There's always been these pinnacles. I always think that I've reached the pinnacle, you know,
yeah.
And then something else comes up.
That's even bigger.
Yeah.
You still there with us, Bill? Oh, we've lost you, Bill. Well, we'll call you right back, Bill, and we'll get you right back because I'm telling you that is one heck of a story that you've got. And let's hope that you don't have phone problems. Isn't it interesting that every time somebody gets involved in government, they're gone. Their phone gets clipped right at the last moment. So I'll keep talking, and we'll talk about this case. Now, see, I was always told that, and I'm going to ask Bill this, that we just simply had a profound case. When Jackie Gleason apparently saw the alien bodies, he just absolutely, it changed his life. He was just never the same after that. And Bill, I want to ask you that when we get you hooked back on. And my gosh, what a story it would be. But we're also going to talk about a little bit more about the Foo Fighters and General MacArthur's apparent secret report. And now these Foo Fighters were little objects that Japanese and American pilots reported seeing in the South Pacific Theater. And I believe the Nazis in Germany also did too. And that these little creatures that flew around, whatever they were, baffled pilots during World War II. And General MacArthur apparently had a secret Foo Fighter report on that. And, you know, we'll talk with Bill about that as well, too. So, Bill, let's check in and see if we got you. Back with us, Bill?
Yes.
There you go. Boy, you just disappeared.
I'm telling you, you start talking about the government, and there you go.
It happens all the time. all the time.
I've heard it on your show actually happens, so I know I'm not the only one. That says,
I mean, it was
subject.
It was poof. I thought you took a missile attack or something. My gosh!
I'm telling you, I'm still here.
All right, the Jackie Gleason story. When you were with him, I'm told that after he witnessed seeing the bodies, he was never the same. That it was a profound effect on him. Did you notice that at all when you were talking with him?
Yes, I did. In fact, he told me it changed his entire life. I mean, he had, a lot of people may not remember this, but he had a very big summer replacement show during the time when this experience happened. He had one of the first summer replacement shows on CBS, and I guess he walked away from it. They were going to renew it for the fall, and he just walked away from it. And he spent, I believe he said, 3 or 4 years just doing nothing but attempting to get more information on UFOs. But, of course, you know, something like that that happens to you when you're actually given the privilege of seeing, you know, seeing that kind of evidence. I mean, it would have to have that kind of effect, especially on someone with an inquisitive mind who had already read just about everything available. I mean, Gleason subscribed to everybody's newsletter. I mean, he subscribed to mine for a few years before he passed away. He just, you know, he couldn't get enough. He was like a knowledge sponge when it came to UFOs and the paranormal. Whether he, you know, how much he believed, I can't say. He never told me. But I got the impression that after seeing the UFO or whatever it was and the crew members, that he certainly, well, I think it had a permanent effect on him. It definitely changed him. He did tell me that. So that's probably the best way to answer it.
Me too, Bill, and probably you too. You know, if you were invited in and you saw, the craft alone would get you. But, I mean, if you saw actual extraterrestrials in tubes or jars or what have you, I mean, it would really have an effect on you.
And I did ask him. I said, you know, look, how real was this to you? I mean, do you feel like this was something that was set up? He said, no. He said, look, to me, he said, I've been involved in fooling people, if you will, you know, for decades. In other words, I'm in show business. I've, you know, seen sets and tricks and magicians and everything else, you know. And he said, I'm telling you what I viewed, in my opinion, was real evidence for extraterrestrial life. And I was really taken by what he said because, you know, as tough a guy as he was, you could see his eyes were watering when he was telling me the story. It was that profound, and I could imagine that it would be.
If you had slapped him on a lie detector test that day, you think he would have passed?
Oh, I know he would have. In fact, it was interesting that some of the people in the room had told me after he left, I talked with them for a few minutes, and they said, you know, you're really fortunate. I said, well, I know I am. He said, no, you don't understand. So he's only told this story in person to a handful of people, but they said that these two guys, I guess they were either, you know, bodyguards or associates, whatever you want to call them, they said every time I've heard him tell the story, he is not varied in any way, shape, or form. It's been the exact same story. And that in itself, that to me was an additional, bit of impressive evidence, the fact that these two gentlemen had heard him tell the story several times, and he had not in any way, shape, or form varied from what he said he saw.
Let's talk further about General MacArthur's secret Foo Fighter report during World War II. How significant was this report?
I believe it was very important. As I said, my father was a retired Air Force officer. Mm-hmm. He had worked on the report, and I believe that it became something that really interested MacArthur, because we all have heard his famous quote talking about the next war not being an international war but an intergalactic war. I think he became a believer during World War II when he began to realize that not only did Allied flyers see these Foo Fighters, these unusual little balls of light or classic kind of orange and silvery balls that would float around aircraft, but the fact that his pilots, were telling him that they appeared to be intelligently controlled, and the fact that the Japanese pilots and the German pilots saw them as well, I think it made him a believer that something more was going on here. This wasn't something the Russians had or the Germans had or the Japanese had or that we had. It was something from somewhere else. And I know it became a major concern to him just on the fact that he ordered the report. Now, a fellow that I called the colonel, that my dad, it was a friend of my dad who retired to Florida. I got a chance to talk to him about it as well, because he also worked on the report. And he pretty much told me the same thing. He said MacArthur was really serious about this. They were very concerned because no matter what they did, It was almost as if they had absolutely no control over these objects, and all the pilots said the same thing. They felt these objects could have done basically anything they wanted with impunity, you know, that there was no way to no apparent defense against them. If they decide to get hostile, you know, it would have not gone well, probably. And I think that was probably MacArthur's concern as well. So he would take all these debriefings from the pilots, for, you know, the ones that normally went on, and whenever they talk about the Foo Fighters or seeing anything strange, it was that information that was entered into the report, which is now, you know, at least when it was finished. I believe it was finished in 1948. They let it run a few years after the war because once the war was over, the sightings continued. They never actually stopped. And, of course, people see these things today. Just call them different things. But, you know, it was over 10,000 pages long. It was classified. And, you know, you can't get a copy of that report to this very day.
Do you think these Foo Fighters, if they were extraterrestrial, were simply monitoring the war, what was going on? What do you think they were doing?
I believe they were, because one of the things that my father said was there were no direct, as far as he knows, there were no direct altercations. They didn't attempt to do anything provocative involving our aircraft. In other words, they didn't help or hurt the situation. They were just there. You know, they got out of the way when they needed to. But as I said, they also pretty much operated with impunity. You know, they were there and there was nothing you could do about it. In fact, there was a lot of concern because I think initially when people thought they might have been some sort of observation aircraft or some observation device launched by the Germans or Japanese or whoever, the concern was that they were able to watch our aircraft doing what they were doing. And if they did belong to the enemy, it would have given the enemy a huge amount of intel. So that was how the whole situation first came to a head, how MacArthur and other generals became very, very concerned about them.
Bill, I want to talk a little bit about UFO cases in the United Kingdom. Did you do much work in that area?
Yes, I have.
Okay, and what are some of your favorite cases?
Well, one of the things that really interested me is what's going on there right now. You know, of course, we've had all these sightings there in the in Wales and in different parts of the UK, and most of them occurred right around the beginning of June. And what was amazing was, you know, whenever something like that happens, I always wait for the next shoe to drop because, you know, when you hear about three police officers on a police helicopter, you know, report seeing a flying saucer that almost runs into their aircraft. Now, the interesting thing about that was the saucer was coming up from the ground when this happened, you know, and it did not show up on the night vision goggles they had. That was another interesting thing. And when they tried to photograph it, I've been told that a lot of the photographs did not come out. And I started to hear that, and then, of course, we had the story about the guys, the soldiers at an army barracks that saw objects as well. So I thought to myself, you just watch. They're going to come out with an amazing story to explain all this. And then the story of the Chinese lanterns came out. They said, well, apparently there was a gentleman who was a hotel manager who apparently worked for the Turnhill Hall Hotel that launched a bunch of Chinese lanterns. And now they were saying that these were the explanation for the sightings. Because it was a ridiculous explanation. Because
the old lanterns, Bill, the old lanterns. We're going to be back and talk more about these cases. Also, some of your ghost work when we come right back. Bill, back to the United Kingdom again. So people were seeing these objects, and then they were explaining them away as Chinese lanterns.
Well, that was the first thing that happened, and it really was kind of funny because the Chinese lanterns tend to last anywhere from 3 to 15 minutes, and then they burn up. So all these different witnesses that saw these things, you know, it was just amazing to me how, you know, they came out with this quick soundbite answer, and they expected everybody just to believe it. But then you had more and more credible people. You even had people that, for example, recently a flight engineer came forward. He was going to work with another engineer who worked at an RAF base in that area, and he said that he saw these things, and he said, look, I see aircraft all the time, and I'm telling you, this was some type of aircraft, but a type I've never seen before. So you had all these credible witnesses, and the thing that really got me was the fact that they weren't able to actually photograph all these this object, and that it didn't show up on their night vision goggles, which really made, you know, to me that was very, very interesting. And what I guess the thing that really got to me was when that didn't work, the latest thing they've done is they had someone, or they claimed that someone called the police to report the moon as a UFO, you know, so that kind of became a laughing stock. And they've just done everything they can to, in a sense, discredit these sightings. But, you know, the more you want to discredit them, the more you see that something's really going on there. And, you know, the fact that this has been going on all over Britain and for some time, I think it's a mistake to just say nothing's happening. You've not just had stuff in, you know, Wales. You've had things happen in Basingstoke, which is near London. You know, I mean, you've had the photographs taken. You know, it's almost like when the recent rash of lights were seen in Phoenix, and they said, oh, this has to be some sort of a hoax. It has to be a flare sent up on a balloon. And actually, one of the subscribers to my newsletter went out and bought a bunch of these balloons and flares and tried to recreate the experiment. I think it cost her like $200, and she couldn't actually do it. It was impossible. So, you know, it's very easy to come up with quick explanations for things, but not always so easy to make them fit when you take a more than just a five-second look at these things.
Well, that is so true. How about Rendlesham? Did you ever look at that case?
I've looked at it, and I've met a lot of the people involved. You know, Peter Robbins has done a huge number of work on it. I've known him for years and listened to him work on it, some of the stuff that he said about it. I think it's a very credible case. I think a lot more has happened there. You know, I'll tell you something. Again, when you start looking at something and take more than a five-second look, you find out that things have really happened. I personally go along with the story that something landed in the forest. I think that the military commander, one or more, were brought out to it. I think that there were aliens involved. I think something really happened there. I think a lot's happened in the U.K., but it's different than here. People have to understand that the way the U.K. Constitution is set up, their press can be and often is censored. So you've got that problem. You know, of course, we don't have censorship here. We have stupidity. So it really doesn't matter whether we have censorship because, you know, I almost have never met anyone in the normal mass media that didn't, in other words, I guess I could say that they've never met a government press release they didn't like. Because if they could find a quick answer to any of the UFO sightings, you know, whether it be candles or flares or something else or balloons or just crazy people, you know, then that's what they'll use and they'll go on to the next news story.
Before we talk about your ghost investigations, tell us about the car lift cases from New York and New Jersey.
Well, these are amazing, you know, and of course, I've known Bud Hopkins for years. I know he's had a couple of these cases as well, but the one that I had was pretty interesting. I started working on it, and I discovered that during the late 1970s, there was a gentleman that was driving about 60 miles outside of New York City. He was driving on Long Island along Montauk Highway, and that would be the southern shore of Long Island for those who live in the area. And, you know, he's driving along in rush hour traffic, all kinds of cars everywhere, when all of a sudden a classic flying saucer appears above the road. Now, you have to remember something. You know, potentially 10,000 people might have seen this. Certainly thousands saw it. It flashed some sort of a beam down on his car, and it pulled his car up off the road with him in it. Now, the very next memory that he had was being in this bright environment. And he, of course, had no clue what happened to him. He didn't actually see the object because the object was directly above his car. He didn't know what happened. He thought he died or something, but here he is still in his car. So he sees these weird creatures coming towards him, towards the driver's side of the window of the car, and he's scared to death. He goes into the passenger area and kind of tries to crawl down on the floor and hide from them. You know, whatever they are, they invoke a huge amount of fear in him. It's an instant response. Now, they force the window on the driver's side down, and they pull him out of the car. To make a long story short, they kind of subject him to about 12 hours of different environments. You know, normally when people are abducted or when they go through the abduction experience, a lot of them talk about medical experiments and such, but that wasn't his experience. He was made to walk through these cold, wet, and dry environments, kind of going from very cold to desert-like, and just kind of with these creatures. He doesn't remember everything that happened, but the one thing for sure that we do know is that about 12 hours later, and when it was dark, it was nighttime, he was returned on a road about 3 or 4 miles away from where he was taken without his car. Now, when he was returned, he was found walking along the road by a motorist that was concerned about him. He called the police. The police took him to a nearby hospital. Now, the only hospital near there just happened to be a heart hospital. So, you know, they took him to the emergency room. And fortunately for him, one of the people in the emergency room had worked for Sandia Labs at some point previously, and he knew what exposure to radiation looked like. they discovered that this man had been exposed to high levels of ionizing radiation. Now, let's face it, you can't get that just walking down the street, you know? So already we had some evidence that something strange was going on. And the amazing part about it was his car was found several days later in a tree.
In a tree. No tornadoes in the area, right?
No tornadoes. Now, here's the amazing part, okay? They find his car in a tree. They get it out of the tree, and they bring it to, I guess, the Suffolk County area where they keep impounded cars. And when he went to see the car, the first thing he noticed was that it was covered with this bizarre kind of white film and that the driver's side window had been forced down. And he went to get his father because he had forgotten his ID, didn't bring his license with him, nothing. You know, he's traumatized. And by the time he got back to the car impound lot, they told him that the car had been moved to another location. So he went through this song and dance for about 24 hours. He never did get his car back. It was like the car had vanished. They finally, after about a week, they came up with this story that his car was stolen. Now imagine this, okay? When the car was already about 10 years old, you know, and this is a car lot where you've got, you know, Mercedes-Benz and Cadillacs and really nice cars, you know? Why would someone steal a 10-year-old Ford with a busted window and film all over the car when they could have stolen one of the Mercedes or one of the other cars that were in there? So already we begin to smell a rat. You know, something's going on behind the scenes. But when we went back to the road area where this occurred, the first thing I noticed, and I show photos of this in my seminar, also have it available on DVD at UFOGuy.com, you see this fence. Now, apparently, some of the other motorists that I spoke to who, over the years who recall this event, and at that time as well, said that the disc came across a field, hit a tree. After it hit the tree, within a week, half that side of the tree was dead. It hit a fence. You could actually see where there was a kind of an impression left by the disc where it hit the fence. And I took pictures of all this. You could actually trace it just by the physical evidence. You know, as far as where it went, I don't know. But, you know, cases like that, you just got to say, you know, how in the world can you explain that apart from a UFO event? And the amazing thing is right away you've got the cover-up, you know, machine going into high gear. Now, interestingly enough, when that occurred, you know, several years later, I worked on a case where a bus full of people were actually going in front of Casino Park, which is in the borough of Queens, New York City, and they said they saw a UFO hovering in the park. And thousands of people saw this object. It left a crop circle behind, but there were some coincidences between this and the other case. That object hit a tree. Just like in the car lift case, the tree died just on one side, was living on the other. And, you know, there were all these coincidences between all these cases. One of the great things about UFO investigation is you find all this commonality.
Right.
And I'll tell you an even freakier thing, that because of that case, you know, it's like one thing leading to another. Because of my interest in the Casino Park case and because of the physical evidence that got left behind, the case got quite a bit of notoriety. And I heard a story from a gentleman who worked at another park, because I was interested in wondering how many other parks had been, experienced some type of UFO activity. And this was a really amazing story, because I was one of the people that worked in the small zoo at what used to be Flushing Meadow Park, which is where the 1962 to 64 World's Fair had been held. He worked in a small zoo, and he and several other coworkers told me that they came to work one morning after a UFO had been seen the night before and found most of the animals in the zoo dead and mutilated. And I'm like, oh, man, are you kidding me? I mean, you know, it's that way in UFOs, just when you think you've heard everything, you know? And apparently, upon doing some research, I discovered that right after that event, they closed the zoo, leveled it. I'm not only talking about leveling it. I mean, they actually dug up the ground that it was under, you know, refilled it in and completely rebuilt the zoo. Now, we're talking New York City. We're talking the borough of Queens. You have to say to yourself, how can this stuff happen and nobody noticed? But, you know, talk about hiding in plain sight. Stuff happens all the time. And if it doesn't get covered, I can imagine him going to a local newspaper with that or a local, you know, media outlet, perhaps a radio or TV station, and then blowing him off, probably thinking he was crazy, you know. And the stories do sound crazy until you dig a little bit under the surface.
Let's move on now to your ghost investigations. What are some of the things that you've looked at here, Bill?
I'll tell you a ghost story that also involves a UFO in a sense. It happened when I was a kid. There was a place called the Noon, N-O-O-N, Inn, okay? It's a historic building, and it existed in East Meadow where I grew up. East Meadow's on Long Island, and it's in the Mid-Island area. Now, this place had a horrible reputation, you know, for being haunted. It started in 1962. At that time, I guess there were three boys who went in there. And apparently, you know, it was abandoned by that time in the sense that it wasn't really abandoned. It was on private property. But it had been everything from an old inn existing from the 1700s to a bar to a speakeasy. By that time, it was just a building being used for storage, and teenagers would go in there and hang out to drink. And I guess these three boys went in there, and they encountered a vagrant who was using the place to sleep, you know. And somehow they got in a scuffle, and apparently the vagrant stabbed them all to death, and their bodies were found several days later. Now, I remember this as a kid being a big thing. By the time Halloween of that year came around, it got to the point where, you know, people were daring, kids were daring other kids to go in there, you know, kind of became a point of local interest for kids. And one of the things that happened that year was, I guess, some girls and boys went in and, you know, just on a dare to look around just before Halloween. And apparently they claim, or they told the police later, that these weird three faces came out of the wall at them. And these were the faces of the kids that would actually have been killed in the building. Now, on that night, coincidentally or non-coincidentally, talk about odd occurrences, the same vagrant who was later arrested for those murders hanged himself in his cell. So it was one of those ghost cases where you not only had a ghost case, but you had a bunch of circumstantial stuff that happened at the same time. Now, you know, I've heard you talk on your show from time to time about places that are affected by the paranormal, you know, and I think this was one of them because the Noon Inn was later moved to Bethpage Village Restoration, which is a place where they bring a lot of Long Island homes that were set to be destroyed because the county, the town of Hempstead bought the property and wanted to build a pool there, and they ultimately did. Now, I only live two blocks from this location. Here's another interesting event that turns into a UFO event. Shortly after the pool opened, which was a couple of years later, during broad daylight, midday, a classic disc hovered above the pool, scared the daylights out of everyone, seen by thousands of people. Lucky me, unfortunately, I was on vacation at the time, so I missed the whole thing. I've never forgiven my parents for that, you know. But I missed the entire thing. And but what was funny was what happened when we got back. I mean, we came back less than a week later, and we were taking all – we'd been camping upstate, and my parents were taking all the stuff out of the car. And we saw these two guys in suits roaming around the neighborhood. And they were going from door to door. They finally came to our door, and the guy showed my dad an FBI badge. And he said that he was going to be going throughout the neighborhood to reassure people about what had happened while we were gone. Now, we had barely heard about it. One of our neighbors had, you know, come over and talked to us a little bit about it, but we didn't know much of the details. And here's the story he came up with, and this is amazing. He said that something had gotten loose from Brookhaven National Labs, where they were working on these, you know, secret projects. And it was a secret project from there that had gotten loose, and somehow it had ended up over the pool. It had managed to change the color of the pool water. Jeez. So the pool had to be closed for 24 hours, okay? The special team, hazmat team, came in and scrubbed down the pool, refilled up the water. I mean, within 24 hours, the place was open again like nothing happened. But they were trying to tell my dad, you know, this former Air Force officer, that it was almost like saying, well, the neighbor's dog got loose and, you know, ate all your roses or something. You know, it came into your yard and did something crazy. My father just started laughing at him and closed the door, you know, because I'm certain that my father knew more of what was going on than he even told me. But it was an amazingly stupid cover-up story. So we went from having a building there that was haunted to having a pool built that a UFO hovered over. Now, years later, when I started to talk about this in seminars all around the country and at libraries on Long Island, I had a bunch of Town of Hempstead people, including a man named Inspector Larson, who had worked for the Town of Hempstead Department of Public Safety. He remembered this event. And he told me how that he was brought there, along with a lot of other people, to basically close down the pool, get everybody out, and keep the public out. He remembered seeing the water, which he described as kind of a dull red, which is the color it changed after the object hovered above it. And he remembered how the hazmat team came in, emptied out all the water, scrubbed down the pool, you know, with whatever. He didn't know what they were doing because he wasn't allowed to get that close. But he said they took it very, very seriously. He said there were guys in suits walking around. A couple of them had FBI, you know, ID. The police weren't allowed in there, interestingly enough, because they didn't want to bring a bunch of regular police around that would attract attention. They were trying to keep, you know, emergency vehicles and stuff to a minimum. They were trying to act like, literally, like nothing happened. I mean, and the funny part was, I had gone back through all the newspapers, the Long Island Press and Newsday and such, from those days, and I can't find a single thing that this ever even happened as far as getting printed in the paper. I mean, talk about an amazing thing that occurs right in your own hometown. I mean, I had some of my neighbors that were at the pool when this happened, so I know it happened. There was no doubt in my mind about it.
What a bizarre story, though, Bill.
Oh, it's crazy. I mean, and it has ghosts, it has UFOs, and I never forgot it. But you know what? I've encountered so many things like that, where you've had these things happen, and they've just been so quickly covered up. People think that can't happen, but it can and does all the time, especially, you know, Long Island, they're used to that. I mean, there's so many government contractors out there that if you're a member of the UN, you're not even allowed to drive out. If you have diplomatic plates and your car's caught out past Route 110, which is a separating point between Nassau and Suffolk County, since most of the work that goes on involving government contractors occurs in Suffolk, the police will pull you over and ask you what you're doing out there. You know, so they're kind of used to dealing with secret stuff. So I don't imagine it was all that hard for them to get people to come out right away and deal with it. But, you know, I'm fairly certain that this didn't involve something that got loose from Brookhaven National Labs, you know. I'm pretty sure this involved something that was probably a little more difficult to explain and left a lot of questions that the government just really didn't want to answer. And it was the first time I've actually seen, though, you know, FBI agents coming through an area and just trying to reassure people. So it must have been a pretty incredible event. Visually speaking, there were some pictures taken, although, see, what the FBI did, they did it in a very casual way. They didn't demand people's photos, but they said, you know, if you have any photos of this, it would really help us to write up our report, you know. And they kind of hinted that if you didn't give them the photos, you were being unpatriotic, which in those days was a big thing. So I've never been able to get a photo of the actual events, although I know some were taken, and who knows, you know, if someone listening tonight has them, you go to my website at ufoguy.com and, you know, email me and let me know. I'd love to see a photo of it. But sure, I mean, it was a beautiful day, George. It was broad daylight. This happened. It wasn't something that happened at night in the middle of nowhere, you know. Where this occurred in East Meadow is right off of Newbridge Road, so it was a major, major intersection, probably less than a mile from the parkway and just a couple of miles from the expressway.
These are great stories, Bill. We'll talk a little bit about ESP, and we'll open up the phone lines next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, aren't these fascinating stories with our guest, Bill Nell? His website, UFO Guy, G-Y, that's it, UFO Guy, G-U-Y.com. We'll be back. We'll take his phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM. Tell me a little bit, Bill, about your work with ESP, and then we'll take the calls.
Sure. Well, a couple of things. I guess the most interesting case I worked on was when I started the UFO Club in high school, one of the people involved in the club was a gal named Jenny. And Jenny was very, very smart. She was an honor student. And she had this amazing, uncanny ability to predict things. For example, the things that she mostly predicted, unfortunately, were people's deaths. And, I mean, I've witnessed this firsthand. For example, I remember one time I went over to see a friend of mine. And this was a girl who would I'd met, first year in high school, and her brother. And we were over talking to them. And Jenny started acting very strangely during the time we were just sort of visiting with them. And we had planned to go swimming later that day. And Jenny said something like, well, you know, we're not going to be going swimming later. I'm like, why? Well, I'll tell you later. So we got back in the car, and we were going to come back to their house a little bit later. We were all going to go swimming. At that time, I was living in Florida and on the Gulf Coast. So, you know, it's warm most of the time there. And she said something about you're not going to be seeing her again. I said, what? And whenever she did this, she went into this weird kind of voice, you know, as if it wasn't her talking, but it was her talking. And amazingly or sadly, later that day, the sister was, in fact, run over by a car. That was the first time that I saw that happen. I mean, myself. There were other times. I remember her saying something about a problem with the president. And then, you know, not long after that, Watergate starting up. You know, I mean, she just had, you know, she'd almost be like the newspaper the day before things happened, but only sporadically. You couldn't ask her about anything. She'd just come out with these things. And, you know, people like that always interested me. Like I said, we were talking earlier in the show, and I was telling you about a guy that that I originally thought was a ghost case that I met in Chicago, who basically saw a woman walking through his house. And then later on, it wasn't a ghost. It was a full apparition, you know, full. It looked like any real person, except they weren't actually there. And then several years later, he met this woman and married her. You know, cases of precognition have always fascinated me. And when you investigate these cases, and when you deal with these people that have this precognitive ability on a one-to-one basis, in other words, when they make the predictions where they're actually standing there, it's spooky. It's just downright scary.
How come she didn't warn the girl, though, that she was going to get hit by a car?
Well, here's the thing about her. There's something I left out because it's even freakier, but I'll go ahead and throw it in. And it's going to sound pretty strange. Of course, I haven't talked about anything strange yet tonight.
Yeah, right.
But, well, you know what? This is what she told me. When she spoke in his voice, she told me she was an angel. That's actually what she said. I don't know that I ever believed that, but I can tell you this. She sure, you know, she could change her eye color at will. She could make these predictions. I never knew what to make of it. I lost track of her after about 2 years because her and her family moved. But she scared the, you know, she scared the daylights out of me. I was like, you know, because she'd go. In fact, I remember one time, and this really freaked me out. She told me the story how that she was horseback riding with a friend of hers. She loved horses, a big thing in her life. And the friend fell down off her horse and was severely injured. Another friend that was with him went to get help. You know, this was the day before cell phones or anything. So she had to go back and go get help. And while this was going on, while the friend was injured, she went into this angel mold and told the friend what was wrong with her, said that she had a fractured bone in her leg and that she would be fine. And when they got to the hospital, they discovered, yeah, she had a fractured bone in her leg and she'd be fine. On another occasion, I was actually at the beach with her. We were swimming. And they dragged this guy out of the water who had drowned. And he looked as dead as a doornail to me. I mean, the guy looked pale. You know, he was gone. His family was there crying. And she went into her angel mode, and she basically, or this whatever mode you want to call it, you know, that's what she claimed it was.
She could have been channeling. Who knows?
Exactly. I mean, I just don't know what to say about it. But I know that she told the family he would be all right. Now, interestingly enough, my mother, who was a nurse at that time, was working at Palms of Pasadena Hospital in South Pasadena, Florida. And that's exactly where he was brought. So I called her later on. She was working in the emergency room, and I told her about this guy being brought in that had drowned. And she said, oh, yeah. I said, well, he's fine. I said, what do you mean he's fine? I said, the guy was dead. I said, well, they put him on a board, and they revived him. I mean, I got to tell you, George, that really freaked me out. I mean, that was the one person that I knew. I mean, there's a lot of things that don't bother me, but she scared the daylights out of me. She just had this ability to do this. And I've never met anyone quite like her that had that much ability, but I've certainly met a number of people that have had these precognitive. Also, I've met people that have had retrocognition, where they've seen events that have occurred in the past. You know, a lot of times we hear about the ghost stories, things that happened at Gettysburg, and a lot of people think that a lot of the sightings there are just really viewings of the past, not necessarily ghosts.
Okay, let's take some calls. How about, do you still stay in touch with her, by the way?
You know what? I have not heard from her. A friend of mine told me that she had moved overseas, whether that's true. And I know she came from a very wealthy family, so that's entirely possible. But she was a very mystical person. And like I said, I didn't really make a lot of efforts because, hey, at that time, I think I was about 16 years old. And, you know, it frightened me to see her go into these modes, especially since, you know, in those days, there wasn't a whole lot of research, solid research into ESP. And most of the scientific community was debunking it. And, you know, how are you going to go to somebody? I was even afraid to tell my friend that was running helped me run the UFO club that was a science teacher about her because I thought he would think I was crazy.
Jim in Florida, you're up with us. You'll be the first call of the hour. Hi, Jim.
Hi, George. How are you? And Bill?
Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you? I'm calling from Alachua, Florida. I recently relocated from the Miami area up to this portion of the country. And the reason I'm calling, I've been waiting for the perfect guest to come on with a perfect subject. And tonight, Bill, you hit it right on the mark when you talked about Jackie Gleason. My mother used to book golf engagements for the pastor of our church between him and Jackie Gleason in the Miami area. And I had always heard that it was Homestead Air Force Base that Mr. Nixon took Jackie Gleason out to view what he had seen, which changed his life. And I'd like to see if I could maybe get a hold of the pastor's wife, who I'm still very good friends with. We're like family. And see if she might be able to shed some light on the incident.
What do you think?
Well, again, you know, I've heard this too. You know, see, but one of the reasons for the Homestead thing, I think, came from Beverly McKittrick, who had been married to Gleason at the time this occurred. And I think that, see, you know one thing about Gleason, when it came to stuff that he did, he was a very private man. I really don't think that he told her all the details of his visit to what he told me was MacDill. I think he didn't even mention a location. I could see just from talking to him that if he wanted to tell you details, he would, but I'd be willing to bet that if he didn't, he wouldn't. And I know that by the time this occurred, his relationship with Beverly was already very, very strange. You know, they eventually did divorce. So I don't know how much he told her, how little he told her. I think everyone just assumed that this was Homestead, but, you know, again, and it might have been, but I could tell you what he told me was that it was MacDill. And you know what was impressive to me, because I'd been on the base. Like I said, my father had been a former Air Force officer. He'd gone to the PX there many, many times to gas up and buy stuff at the PX, you know, even as a retired officer. And I can tell you, he knew that base very well. Just from what he described, I knew for a fact he'd been on the base. And I can't think of a reason in the world other than his visit on that particular occasion that he would have went there. So his knowledge of the base was impressive. I knew the base. I knew the building he went to. So I still tend to think it was probably MacDill, or at least, you know, what can I say? That's what he told me.
You know, it's interesting, too, just about the story. That means Nixon would have been one of the few presidents that they told this to. Because,
well, you know,
they held back on the other ones.
Huge amount of, I mean, he was vice president to Eisenhower, you know, and everyone assumes that Eisenhower was briefed or eventually told everything. So
yeah,
I would
yeah.
think he would have known.
Yeah. Okay, next up, let's go to Francis in California. You're up with us. Hey, Francis.
Hello there. And I'd like to talk to your guest.
He's gotcha.
Did you live in Gulfport?
Yes, I did.
You went to Bogusiega?
Yes, I did.
And Diston? And Gulfport Elementary?
I never went to, no, I didn't move there until in my later, you know, until I was, I think we moved there when I was just starting high school.
What
probably the first time I went to any schools there would have been in 10th grade, so I would have been a sophomore at Bocasiega.
In what year?
That would have been 1970, I believe it was 71.
Okay, because that's, we lived there then.
Are you his teacher?
Pardon?
Well, are you his teacher?
No, but I knew George Michel very well.
Wasn't he an amazing guy?
Yes, he was. By the way, I had made arrangements for Professor Benson Valentine in Miami to come and meet with George Michel and myself and a few others. George had found, with a guide, an ancient remains of a city in the Everglades. And he had.
I remember that.
And he had pictures, and when we were supposed to go is when George had the heart attack and died when he was out fishing.
How old was he when he went, Francis?
He wasn't that old. He was in his 50s, I would say.
Yeah, that's young.
He was the harbor master at Port of Call at one time, and then he was on WSUN, I believe, the same one I was on.
That's right.
I wanted to ask one question. Back in about 65, 66, a young fellow had just mustered out of the Army. He was one of the original Green Berets, and he was lieutenant colonel, and he was driving his wife crazy. So his friend says, "Will you please let him to work?" And I said, "Yes." So we were painting a house over on Shore Acres, and he says, "Will you go outside?" I was having a cigarette. He says, come here. I says, "What's wrong?" And we were just overlooking Tampa Bay. There was a tanker refueling a jet, and he made a little facetious remark, and I said, "Oh, come on." And it was coming over Tampa Bay, but it would have been Not over MacDill, but maybe to the little to the south. It was a very clear day and a little puffy cloud here and a puffy cloud there, so a cumulus cloud. So out of this cloud comes three silver discs and go zoom, zoom, zoom around the tanker and the jet. And I says, oh, my gosh. And then they split off into three and went off in different directions and just disappeared. And then within an instant, they were all back again and going round and round the jet and the tanker. And I says, oh, my gosh, I hope they're ours. And my friend said, they're not. Well, I found out later, this friend who had moved to Arizona from St. Petersburg, he was one of the original investigators of a UFO craft in White Sands. And this was after Roswell, but he was one of the original investigators. And I was asking, well, did they look anything like that thing on TV that they had? And he said, well, a little bit. He said there were some survivors of that crash and where they were taken. Some were dead, some were alive. And he said they stayed alive for a couple of years. And they were finally able to communicate with them. But I asked him, why were these things crashing? He said it was our radar, that it was interfering with their instruments.
Oh,
have you heard that?
It's a great story.
You know, there were so many sightings in that area. I mean, when we had the UFO club, we couldn't even keep up. In fact, there was an area there that very ancient called Jungle Prada that's famous because Al Capone once had a club there, and it was a huge hotel nearby that ultimately became Admiral Farragut Academy. At one time, it was a very exclusive hotel. But in that area, there's these old Native American mounds, and there are sightings over there all the time. And, in fact, not just UFO sightings. I remember going out there, and we went on this big Bigfoot hunt, if you will. At the same time the UFOs were being reported, there were, you know, really solid witnesses claiming that they saw this Bigfoot-type creature just kind of swimming in the water and getting out of the water, and there were footprints, and the media came, and people were calling into radio stations. You know, it's just one of those kind of paranormal-type areas where there's just so much stuff going on, and it all seems to relate somehow to UFOs. You know, I've often thought, well, suppose, you know, some of these things open up some sort of a time-space portal. I'd always felt there was one near the Jungle Prada because of all the activity. And then, of course, consequently, Gulfport, Pasadena, St. Pete, and Tampa have for years been just this hub of UFO activity. So who knows?
Okay, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line, Andre in California. Hey, Andre.
Hey, George, how's it going?
Good.
First-time caller, but a long-time listener.
Good to have you with us, Andre.
I have a question for your guest. Bill, is it?
Yeah, hi, Andre.
Hi, I got a question. I was talking with a friend of mine a couple months ago, and we were talking about the UFO situation, and he had brought up something that kind of made spark my interest. Was he was saying that he heard from somewhere that about a couple years before Roswell, that we were seeing all these UFOs and sightings of UFOs, and that we were being the government and the time that we actually might have shot one down, and that could have been the Roswell accident.
Well, the only thing I know that, you know, my father was an Air Force officer, but he didn't talk about much as far as what he knew about UFOs. But listening to some of the stories that he and other people talked about when they'd come over to visit with him, I have to make an assumption that the government may have had UFOs in their possession as early as even the 1920s or 30s. Some of these might have come from other places, not just the United States. But I know there was one story that was pretty interesting involving the USS Alabama, a battleship that apparently had brought at some point, either I believe just before the war or just after. I'm not sure because I've never been able to fully follow up the story. But I met enough ex-crew members to know that they had a disc-shaped object on a tarpaulin on the deck that the battleship brought it back to the United States. And eventually, the U.S. Army took possession of it. So there's all kinds of stories like that. It's hard to know. But I have a feeling that the government's known about UFOs a lot earlier than Roswell. Just the fact that once the, Washington form of the government, not the local authorities in Roswell, the local Air Force base, but it's amazing how smooth it was that they were able to cover everything up and pretty much, close the lid on it. It's almost as if they had practiced it. They were apparently prepared for this and had everything in place to deal with it.
Did you ever investigate, Bill, ancient UFO cases? I mean, those from antiquity?
Well, you know, I've been a good friend of Zachariah Sitchin for years, so I spent a lot of time with him, you know, talked to him about his theories on him and others. And I believe that I'm convinced that we have been visited by ancient astronauts. I'm convinced that they've been visiting us for a very long time. One of the things that I found interesting was that living in Arizona, of course, there's stories about the Grand Canyon and finding Egyptian hieroglyphs there and odd bits of material, drawings of discs on cave walls. You know, I certainly think that we've been visited in ancient times by the ancient astronauts. I'm certain of it.
Well, I am too. Let's go east of the Rockies. Bob in Texas. Go ahead, Bob.
Hey, George.
Hey.
This is the second time I've talked to you in a couple of weeks now. The first time you told me I had an infectious laugh when I told you about the story of me on the roller coaster ride.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. I've been a fan of, more or less aficionado of UFOs for a long time. So I'm calling on behalf of myself and also a friend of mine out here in Katy named Boyd, who I hate to say it, but thinks Richard Hoagland is not credible. But anyway, he's going to be listening to this at Streamlink tomorrow morning, so I wanted to get my point in. I've got a T-shirt that says, Fly Alien Air, only one accident in 47 years. It's kind
well,
of...
Also, though, I'll tell your friend, Richard's probably one of the most astute guys with science I've ever talked to.
Okay. Well,
you may not agree with his theories of Cydonia and things like that, but I mean, in terms of understanding real science, he's one of the best. But go ahead with your. I'll tell you what. Let me put you on hold because we're already up against the break here, and I'll come right back and get you, Bob, as the first question of the half with our special guest tonight, Mr. Bill Nell, who's just done one incredible job telling us these incredible stories. Now, Bill, I know you went to a lot of conferences in the past and speaking engagements. Are you slowing that down, or are you still doing that?
I still do it. I just don't do it as much because it got to the point where I was doing like 100 seminars a year, and that just really, you know, takes a lot out of you. But, you know, I really enjoy sharing my information, the things that I collect and the stories I have with people. What I've done now is I've put a lot of those on DVDs, so when people go to my website at ufoguy.com, they can, you know, pick them up on DVD. And I'm always adding new stuff. There's just... I've never written a book, although I'm trying to write one now. They say it takes a year, but I was brought up in the TV generation. TV was my babysitter, you know. So to me, it's like, well, why put it in the book when you can put it on DVD?
Absolutely. Let's go to you, Dave, in Massachusetts. Take it. Up. Our other caller, he hung up, I think. All right, Dave, you go ahead.
Hi, George.
Good to have you with us, David. Go ahead.
I've been calling for a year. I finally got through, and it's an honor to talk to you finally.
Good. Thank you.
I have a comment and a question. A comment is about your music you play in between commercials. It's excellent. Your taste in music is excellent, except you're missing one song. I can't believe you never play it, and it pertains to tonight's subject.
What is it?
Have you ever heard of 10 Years After?
Yes.
I'll have
the voice check that. Okay, go ahead.
Here They Come is the name of the song, and you've got to play it once in a while.
I'll have them pull it out, and we'll check it out for you, David.
Anyways, a lot of new shows seem to come on and off the air, UFO hunters, paranormal shows, ghost hunters and such. It seems that... they're only in it for the ratings. Integrity doesn't seem to be there. Do you agree with that, Bill?
I think that's somewhat true. I mean, look, you know, there's a big difference between entertainment and information, whether we like it or not. You know, I watch the stuff on cable like everybody else, and, you know, it's not the best stuff that's out there. It's just stuff that people collect, you know, and put on TV. You know, I've been very fortunate myself. I'll never judge anyone else's work, you know, because you know what? We're all in this for the same thing. You know, we all try to get the information out, and if TV's interested in it, they're interested in it. I mean, I've worked with shows, too, but not on those levels, you know. But, you know, my attitude is this. When it comes to UFOs, if the information gets out to people, that's a good thing. I'm disappointed in most of the shows that are out there right now because I think a lot of them are, you know, they're just kind of like MTV-esque, if you will. They don't really get to the meat of the matters. They don't cover some of the better cases, some of the more amazing things. Hey, that's why we listen to Coast, right?
Right.
Okay, thanks, Dave.
Let's
move on. Let's go to John in Los Angeles. You're on the air. Hey, John.
Hey, how you doing?
We're doing great. Thanks.
Quick story and a question. This was either in 1965 or 1966. I don't remember which it was. My father was also in the Air Force, and we were stationed in France, a little town called Etain. It was in north of France, about 100 kilometers or so from Paris. But we were getting ready to go to the movie one night, and it was not quite dark, but the stars were out, but it was kind of dark, twilight. I remember looking off to the south, and from east to west, it was a point of light. I don't know what it was. I couldn't see it that close, but it moved fast. It went from one horizon to the other in a matter of seconds. And when I saw it, I told my dad, I said, look. And he turned around and looked, and we both watched it go, and he just scooted. I never seen anything move so fast. He just turned around, looked at me, shrugged his shoulders, got in the car, and went on our way. We never talked about it again. But I was just wondering, were there any sightings or any UFO stuff going on in France, 65, 66?
Well, you know, you probably could now go back and look at some of the records they've released and check it out for yourself. I have a link on my website at ufoguy.com. If you go there, you can link up to the website that the French have put up. There's some English versions where you can literally go through some of their information that they've now released. So I don't know if anyone specifically reported anything, but I know you can find out for sure and probably even look it up in terms of the town or at least the locality.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm sure you saw Close Encounters of the Third Kind, right, Bill?
Oh, yes. I'll never forget that movie. Can I give you a quick story with that?
Yeah.
One of the reasons is I was with a friend, one of my best friends in the world named Richie. Now, Richie was a very down-to-earth guy, never talked about UFOs. He knew I had an interest in it, and I practically had to drag him to see the movie, you know. But I really wanted to see it. I wanted to see it on the big screen. I was living in New York at the time, so we went to a big New York City theater, saw it on the big screen, and I loved it. I thought it was great. But my friend Richie was, like, all disturbed after the movie, and I found out later that him and his sister, interestingly enough about Florida, had been traveling through Florida a couple of years before. Now, when we saw the movie, he was only 19, and I was probably about 20. But when he was several years before that, when he was a little bit younger, they stopped at a motel overnight, and him and his sister lost some time. The last thing they remember is playing in the playground and seeing this huge light coming towards them out of the sky. And then, they must have lost about 3 or 4 hours. Their parents were really concerned because they couldn't find them, didn't know what happened to them. And then all of a sudden, there they were at the door to the hotel room, you know. And he said, you know, oh, my goodness, you know, something might have happened to me. And he said, I never remembered this until I saw the film. It was like the film was this catalyst to help him remember it. So I will never forget my first viewing of that film for that specific reason.
Okay, International Line, you're up with Bill Nell. Hi there. Hello? Well, I heard him breathing, but that's about it. Let's go to our first-time caller line. We've got Howard in Illinois. Go ahead, Howard.
Yeah. I've never heard any discussion on this topic. Have you ever heard of the U.S. government ever returning any alien bodies, either living or not?
Well, you know, there's stories like that out there. I can't prove any of them. I don't know if they're true. But I know for a fact that there have been stories of exchanges. Now, this case that's going on in England with this fella named Gary, who apparently hacked in to all these military sites here in the U.S. and they recently had a court hearing to decide whether he should be extradited here to the United States. I've got an article on it on my website. Basically, he claims that there are what you might call off-world officers, okay, that serve in the military. Apparently, he says they serve off-world. Whether that's true, I don't know. But if that is true, there might be an indication that there's some sort of exchange between our military and these aliens, or at least one type of these aliens. And I'm almost certain, if that's the case, that there would be the returning of, if not hardware, perhaps bodies. Who knows? You know, then again, we don't know their culture. It may not be a part of their culture to have that be a very important thing, at least not as important as it is to us. But I have heard stories like that, yes.
Bill, did you ever investigate the Dogon tribe and the Sirius mystery?
I've read about that since I don't even know. I think I was one of the first, but it was mentioned in one of the first books I've read. You know, when you read stuff like that, you just say, wow, you know, how did this obscure tribe have all this information about the universe, you know, and about the Sirius system? It makes you wonder.
It was a great story, isn't it?
Absolutely. People should read that if they ever get a chance to look into that.
Steve in California, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, George.
Hi.
Bill, listen, I called in about, six, 7 months ago, and I was telling George, I told George about a trip that I took with a friend of mine up to Sequoia, and we had driven off of Honolulu Road and Highway 65, and about 10 minutes down the road, we kind of drove into kind of an orangish cloud. And that was the last thing I remembered until I was pulling up to a stop sign, and it was dark. And this had happened about, say, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And the long story short was it was about – we ended up 60 miles away from where we last recollected being anywhere on that highway. And about 11 and a half hours later. And when you told the story about the guy whose car ended up in the tree
– yes.
The same guy that had the radiation burns?
Yes.
Well, do you know what kind of marks they left or what was there? Because I had George asked me if I remembered anything or if I saw anything the last time I called, and I said no. But the truth is I had these marks on my chest, and I also had a dream about it where I was in a room, and there was a woman standing in front of me who was trying to calm me down. Because I was screaming at whoever these people or beings were that were behind her. There was maybe six or seven of them in the dream, and I was screaming at them at the top of my lungs and using profanities I never knew I possessed. And she was trying to calm me down through all of this. And that's really my only recollection of it, other than those marks that I had on my chest.
What do they look like, if you don't mind me asking?
They look a little bit like cigarette burns, except that they didn't have an actual – they had like a little piece of white, like flake on the top of them, red welts like stings, but with a little bit of a flaky kind of skin on them. You could kind of rub it off, and then it would come back in a few hours. And I had them for almost 10 years, and then they finally disappeared.
Well, I know that the Carliff case I talked about, and another one that occurred in New Jersey, where a gentleman was driving his car probably about 35 miles from New York City on the Jersey side during rush hour traffic. When his car was lifted up, he was returned in his car about 8 hours later. But in both cases, the gentleman had marks on their back. Now, I don't know. I don't recall them telling me, and I questioned them for a very long time about any marks on their chest. But I know they had odd marks on their back, which looked like these kind of weird four-fingered marks, like they'd been scratched by something. But coincidentally, the first Carliff case, the one where the car was found in a tree, he had had subsequent experiences. And it wouldn't be unusual for me to go to his house and find these four-fingered scratch marks around the outside of his windows, as well as evidence in his backyard that something had landed. So, you know, I don't know if that helps you, but those are the only type of marks that I'm aware of.
Right. Well, I'm telling you guys the real short version of this story, even when I called in last time, and I won't go into it because it's just too involved, but it actually started a couple of weeks before this trip. But it has, when you said that it changed the man's life, I mean, and when you were talking about Jackie Gleason and how it changed his life from the time that he saw whatever Nixon showed him, and I have to say that it has affected my life profoundly since this happened, and this was in 1988, August of 1988, and things have not been the same since. They just haven't, and I don't need convincing, you know.
Do you recall if they ever gave you anything during those encounters?
No, I don't remember. I don't remember that, but I do remember running into an incident that happened 2 weeks before this. If you ever stuck those things you use in the summertime where you dip them into bubbles and you blow them through, well, if you remember what it looks like just before, when you pull it out in the sunlight, when it's still on that little ring, that what that veil looks like, or that it's got, you know, it's soap, but it's got colors in it and so forth.
Right, like almost like a rainbow type effect.
Exactly. Well, that the lady that I was with when we were driving down the highway, this happened to two of us, and she called me back to the back room of her house and said, "Look at this." And over the whole door was this film just like that. And that was the first thing that I had any kind of feeling that something wasn't quite right. And I pulled out my Zippo lighter out of my pocket, and I went ahead and I put it into this stuff, and it did just remove it completely from the door. And but as far as giving me anything, I don't recall that. Like I say, I only had the dream, and it was very vivid. And I woke up screaming, and my wife was saying, "Honey, it's only a dream. It's only a dream." And but it was an awfully real dream, you know, and that's pretty much it.
Well, but in both the Carliff cases, there was a weird white film that was covering both cars. And the only reason I asked if they gave you anything was, one thing that really kind of got to me was that the only thing that the guy from the first Carliff case, where his car was allegedly stolen, of course, you know, the only thing he was able to retrieve was, they had apparently at the impound lot taken out a small tool chest that he had had. He was an electronics engineer, and he had this little tool chest that he kept in the back. They took that out of his car, and they managed to give that back to him. It was the only thing he was able to get. But he found this weird metallic thing. It almost looked like a little wheel. That's the best way I can describe it. I didn't see it. He made a drawing of it. And he said he probably had it for about a month until they eventually came back, took him again, and took it back. The Carliff case from New Jersey, the exact same thing, except they gave him something which almost looked like a little chestnut. That's the best way I can describe that. They didn't tell him what it was for or why he had it, but he found it in the trunk of his car after the event, and didn't know what it was, but he did remember after the next time, a little bit longer, maybe a month and a half after he was taken again, abducted again, it was taken back from him. And from time to time, they'd give them stuff and then take it back. That's the only reason I asked, because, you know, looking for some kind of commonality. But, yeah, both cars did have a bizarre white film on it, which, of course, I wish I had the opportunity to have that examined. I guess the second guy who did get his car back had his car washed almost immediately. I think he was just so freaked out. He was trying to put the whole thing behind him.
We needed
but I
samples,
told him, I said, "I really wish you'd save some of that stuff for me, you know."
Yep. It's east of the Rockies, Dan in Alabama. Go ahead, Dan.
Good morning, George, Bill.
Hey.
Hey, I was wondering, have you ever been to Montauk? The reason why I ask is the daughter, I believe, of one of the top scientists there, said in that town that there was a lot of, like, clone-looking people. Tall, blonde people. I just wonder if you know anything about them.
Oh, I can tell you a bazillion stories. I was the guy to introduce the original Montauk people to the public, and I can tell you stories and stories. I'll tell you a cool story involving Bruce Willis. He used to rent a piece of property out there. He saw one of my cable shows that was running on Long Island, and he was really concerned because he believed that there were all these UFO abductions going on out there, and he was right. There's a lot of UFO abductions. There are strange people that walk around the town almost with, like, blank looks on their face, you know. Sometimes there's the doppelganger effect. That's just a bizarre area with a lot of strange things that happen. Again, if people want to read my articles on it, they're all free. You can go to ufoguy.com and read more about it. But I've got some great Montauk stories on the website. It's just too complicated, unfortunately, and long a subject to get into in a short period of time. But, yeah, definitely one of the stranger places in America.
Bill, take us very quickly through ufoguy.com. What do we find there?
Oh. Tons of free articles, my DVDs to sell, all my seminars on DVD, a lot of stuff. A lot of good reading, you know. Take a couple of years and read it all.
It probably will take that long, won't it?
Yeah, and I'm always adding new stuff. And I've got a free newsletter. So all you got to do is go sign up for it. And, you know, anything that happens that's exciting that I've become aware of or that I'm investigating, you'll get it right in your email box.
Bill, I want to thank you for being on the program. Great stories that you brought to us tonight.
Thanks, George.
Okay, that's Bill Nell. UFOguy.com. Just some incredible stories are absolutely riveting, and he will be invited back, no doubt. For Karis Coburn, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, George Knapp, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.